I don't. I just started Snapchat. I have like seven people.
Well, Hot Takedown fans are going to come and find you.
Look, this was me on the subway.
There you go.
And I was walking to the studio.
Great. We want to see those details of your life. You're glam.
And then I went to makeup, and then I went to the studio, and then it was over. Who thinks that's interesting?
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are all rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is as a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker. And a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me, all together in the studio today, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad. You came in real quick there off of the intro.
You know, I've got new directions, new instructions about how to come in. You like
it? Hit the ground running.
All right. I like it, too. Thanks, Joe, for that tip. Neil Payne, also in the house. Hello, Neil.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Neil, in your day job, you're an editor and writer at 538. About sports. True.
That's correct.
True. A lot to talk about today. We've got, well, I'm not going to tell you what we've got to talk about. Because first, we're going to talk about the women's bracket challenge, which we neglected in our flash pod to say who won and who lost. And therefore, who gets the t-shirt, the hot blue t-shirt of Adam Silver riding a bear into a pool of fish to determine the winner of the NBA draft.
Is it Hot Takedown blue? Do we have our own color?
Yeah, Crayola trademarked it.
Yes. Look out, Burnt Sienna.
There are ties at the top and the bottom of the bracket. If you are listening, Young T Swimmer 00 or Shiesty Bracket WESBN 13700874, we're looking for you. Please get in touch or we'll get in touch with you. Losers, there are four of you who ended up in the bottom. March Sadness, Chai Goose, Shane Delmore, B17 Batty, ESPN 760-68552. I think my copy and paste job may have introduced some inadvertent numbers in here. And Tank for Silver, Bisbees.
You know who you are, though.
Yeah, you know who you are, Tank for Silver. Nate,
you know who you are,
get
these
t-shirt.
Random number
you know
strings.
You know who you are, 7606.
The robots are coming. All right. On today's show, we're going to place Jordan Spieth's collapse at the Masters in historical context and wonder whether golf is the most psychologically volatile sport that we have. And then Sam Hinkie, the man, the myth, the process. With Hinkie out as the GM of the 76ers, we will make sense of his departure, his legacy, and where the Sixers go from here. And then to the Stanley Cup playoffs, which begin this week. The field is wide open with no clear favorite, which means Neil is going to once again remind us just how random the Stanley Cup playoffs are. And then a special sig dig.
Oh, yeah.
That Kate Fagan dug up for us.
It's my contribution.
It involves foul balls and where to catch them and
numerous,
how best to catch them. Get ready.
Numerous foul balls.
All right. Jordan Spieth was up 5 strokes going into the 10th hole at the Masters on Sunday and still managed to lose by 3 strokes in the end. It was a collapse for the ages, one that left Spieth ashen-faced during the jacket ceremony and set golf's nattering class a-Twitter. To help us understand what happened at Augusta and whether it was a fluke or something larger in Spieth's game, we've called up Shane Ryan, who writes for Golf Digest and is the author of the book Slaying the Tiger, A Year Inside the Ropes on the New PGA Tour. Shane Ryan, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing, guys? Thanks for having me.
Shane, before I get your thoughts on what happened with Spieth, let's listen to Patrick Meagher, a host at Mad Dog Radio.
It was an epic choke job of ridiculous proportions by Jordan Spieth, the 22-year-old kid from Dallas, Texas. He was attempting to go wire to wire. And guess what? He did. He really, really did until the back nine. Because Willett won it. Spieth may say he lost it. He lost the choice for back-to-back green jackets, and he lost his mind. Just a traumatic, epic collapse.
He lost it. Yeah.
He lost it. He did go wire-to-wire,
except he didn't.
He didn't.
Shane, when you were watching this, you watch much more golf than I think any of the three of us do. Did this seem as unbelievable to you as it did to the lay audience that was watching?
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, what distinguishes Jordan Spieth's collapse from, you know, the Greg Norman collapse that's so famous in Augusta or a lot of other collapses we've seen, are that those tend to happen over the course of a day. Like, Greg Norman started choking on the first hole of Sunday, and by the end he had lost like a 5 or 6 stroke lead. Spieth, on the other hand, came out and shot 4 under on the front nine, which is like a dream front nine. You know, he had experience winning the Green Jacket last year, and he's won the U.S. Open as well. So to see him suddenly collapse like that when he seems so in command of his game, it was a total shocker. I mean, it was probably, I would say easily, the most surprising meltdown I've ever seen as a golf fan.
Yeah, because usually, it like you said, it's almost like the guy, you know right away that he doesn't have it that day for whatever reason, and then that can kind of like, you know, snowball. But in this case, he had it, and then he just hit. Maybe the degree of the shots or like the degree to which they were bad was so shocking too, especially on 12.
Yeah, it's so funny to think back to what happened over those three holes. So, you know, he had this huge lead. And then he bogeyed 10 and 11, which is, you know, obviously it's not a meltdown. Those are two of the most difficult holes in professional golf. So he had bogeys on those, which is no big deal. But then he comes to 12, and he's still got a two-shot lead. But I think when you're on the back nine of the Masters, this idea that you might be collapsing can, especially for someone aggressive and good like Jordan Spieth, can kind of force you into making these crazy choices. So when he was on the tee, instead of hitting a draw shot, which is pretty safe and which could go long, he tried to be really perfect because he wanted to reverse these bogeys and make like a spectacular birdie and kind of put everyone away. And so he hit a fade, and it came up short, and it went in the water. And all of a sudden then, I think, you know, I don't think even that shot was a choke. I think he just got unlucky. But then the next shot that he fatted into the water was probably the worst shot he's ever hit in his career, and that was 100% a choke. And so it's like, you just see how, like, slight pressure can become more pressure, can become, like, the biggest disaster we've ever seen.
So, yeah, I feel like I read a lot about whether or not he was playing it too cautiously in the end there. That he was, I think I read someone saying something like he was playing the prevent defense of golf, basically. But what you're saying is that he was actually trying to go for broke after stumbling a bit.
No, he definitely wasn't playing prevent defense on the 12th. Prevent defense would be hitting the right-to-left trajectory draw, which tends to, in general terms, like speaking simply, a fade goes a little bit shorter. Usually it kind of loses distance, and a draw will tend to add distance to a typical club for a pro. So by hitting a draw, his risk was that he would go over the green and be in the bunker, which can result in a bogey. I mean, it's not an easy up and down from there. But if you hit the fade, you know, the plus side is that if you hit it really well, it's going to land right in the green and give you a great shot at birdie. But the negatives are that it could go in the water, which is obviously a much worse fate. So, you know, and he made that choice. You know, he said afterward that he changed his mind while he was standing over the ball. And what's really crazy is he did the exact same thing in 2014 when he was going up against Bubba Watson on Sunday and had a good chance to win. And the same exact thing happened. He put it in the water. But he made that mistake again.
Shane, I know you watch tons of golf, but I'm assuming you also watch other sports. And it seems to me like when I do watch golf, there's just such a different psychological aspect to it, combined with the fact that there's no raised heart rate and adrenaline like you would in basketball or football, where if you make a mistake or a bad play, it's almost impossible to keep it at the forefront of your mind because you have all these variables coming at you on the next play. Whereas on golf, there is certainly your focus on the next shot, but it's not the same sort of like raised heart rate and the difference of like defenders coming at you as you, you know, across the sporting landscape. Do you feel like golf is separate in how debilitating some sort of mistake can be for these guys?
Yeah, 100%. And you pretty much nailed it. There are really two factors that make golf so much different. Number one, like you said, is just the time you have to think between shots. Like if you went through and put a clip together of Jordan Spieth just playing golf over that last Sunday, it's probably, what, like 30 seconds or something, just him swinging the club. And that's a 4.5-hour round. So, you know, 4 hours, 29 minutes, and 30 seconds of thinking. So for sure that pressure can compound. And the other thing is, yeah, other sports like basketball or tennis or almost anything else, one little mistake is not going to kill you. It's not debilitating, and you have time to recover almost immediately. Whereas golf, you know, as we saw with Spieth, two bad shots, it doesn't really matter how well you do the rest of the round. And he was pretty awesome the rest of the round, including after that mistake. Really doesn't matter. If you mess up that one little bit, golf is a sport where you're pretty much done.
Yeah, that gives me a good idea for a 538 data visualization where you're sort of charting the actual active time of a golfer versus the thinking time. And you would, I think, Kate, to your point, basketball and football, absolutely. But we talk about tennis, and tennis maybe being a more psychologically taxing game all the time because you're on your own. But you're still there's still instinctual reactions that are happening as the ball is coming at you from your opponent, as opposed to in golf. So Neil, can you place this within a historical context of collapses? I mean, from a numbers, do we have golf metrics that can sort of get us to a place that can help us contextualize where Spieth's falls?
Well, sure. And I'm curious what you think about this too, Shane, because Ken Pomeroy, who, of course, we said last week that this was the last time that we talk about him because of college basketball. Yeah, he has a golf win probability Twitter feed, and he listed Spieth as 92% to win before his bogey problems began on the back nine, dropped to 85% after he bogeyed the 10th hole, then dropped to 71% after the 11th hole, and then all the way down to 13% after the 12th hole. So, but even at his peak, 92%, watching at home and certainly knowing what we know about Spieth, and I don't think that this necessarily takes into account his stature as a rising, you know, superstar, or perhaps already risen superstar. 92% seems kind of low, maybe. I'm not totally sure, but he was leading by 5 strokes going into the back nine of the Masters. But maybe that also speaks to how much of a chance there is for disaster to strike,
even against
in
mediocre
golf.
Competition.
Even against, yeah, competition. That, and we should say, and maybe we'll talk about this later also, that Willett actually was ranked 12th in the world. He's not some scrub, like, you know, I think a lot of the post reactions were making him out to be. And he played great too, but I'm curious what your thoughts are, Shane, about this 92% that Spieth had and the drop that it took as he made these bogeys.
First of all, you're dead right about Willett. He's a really good golfer. He's going to win more majors. And the thing that a lot of people forgot in that post-round narrative is that when Spieth collapsed, it wasn't like he was sitting in the clubhouse and just backed his way into it. You know, he was still on the 15th hole, and he had to play really good golf coming in to win. So he did a great job. But yeah, that 92% number, it actually seems about right to me, just because of how much variability you can have in 9 holes of golf and how pressure affects people. And the other thing about Spieth that's interesting, I mean, it's always tempting to retrofit a narrative, but he, by his own really high standards, he was playing some pretty crazy golf over those 4 days. And he's such a good putter that he was making, you know, 10-foot par putt after 15-foot par putt, and he was really kind of saving himself with a short game. But he was pretty erratic off the tee. You know, his irons weren't perfect. He was just constantly saving himself. And so, yeah, I would say 92, in my head, that almost even seems high. I would go against what you had said, saying it's low, just because so much can happen at the end there. And, you know, on the 13th and 15th at Augusta, a lot of players still had those left to play, and those are eagle holes. So, you know, a lot can happen. But, I mean, the bottom line, obviously, yeah, he had a great chance to win, and he should have won.
Maybe go into what you said about, you know, saving himself despite the long game not necessarily being as sharp as it can be for him. That maybe that is what presages kind of around falling apart, is if you continually have to put so much pressure on putting, and putting is something that it's really tough to carry yourself with that aspect of the game. I remember there's a guy named Mark Brody that does, and I'm sure you know him, Shane, the guy that does strokes gained, where he sort of like breaks down how much of a golfer's game can be attributed to each phase of the game, whether it's off the tee or, you know, approach shots or putting. And he found that most of what differentiates great golfers is not putting, you know, great golfers from amateurs even. It's the ability to get it to a position where, you know, favorable position off the tee, and then also, you know, with your irons. So maybe those are the more consistent markers of great play. And then if you're constantly having to be bailed out by your putter, eventually that sort of dries up for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, you know, those short game shots are the most based on feel, I guess, and the most based on touch. And so you could argue that they're going to be the first things to go under pressure. So if you don't have, you know, great drives to rely on or great long iron play, which Danny Willett had, you know, you're going to be in trouble the minute that you start to lose this great putting or the great chipping or whatever. I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, Danny Willett, who played so well this week on the 18th hole, he had, I think, a 15-foot putt for birdie, and it was by far the worst putt he hit, probably the entire tournament, and he was kind of just laughing at himself, and it was 100% the pressure. I mean, that was all it was. He was really affected him, and he managed to, you know, sink the 3-foot par putt for par, and he obviously won the tournament. But that kind of thing goes quickly. But what we saw with Willett is his drives were perfect. His irons were really, really good. He didn't lose that. Spieth had already lost that. And once he lost the short game, yeah, forget about it.
All right, Shane, I think we're going to leave it there. Thanks so much for helping explain, I think, a sport that, at least for some of us in the room, I can only speak for myself, feels as though it's a bit of a mystery from the analytics sense. That was super helpful. Thanks, Shane.
Yeah, you got it, guys. Thanks.
Listeners, you can read Shane Ryan's work at Golf Digest, and you can pick up his book, Slaying the Tiger, A Year Inside the Ropes on the New PGA Tour. It took 3 years for Sam Hinkie to take the Philadelphia 76ers, a franchise on the decline, down to the depths of Mariana's Trench. The Sixers went 47-197 under Hinkie's management, 17 wins worse than the next closest team that three-year span. They drafted big man after big man, several of whom have barely played, and became the laughingstock of the league. Last week, Hinkie's reign finally came to an end, spurred by the threat of new competition in the front office. Hinkie resigned. Here's Stephen A. Smith on the Hinkie era.
Sam Hinkie should never be a general manager in a sport again. It is just that simple. Sam Hinkie is a poor man's version of Phil Jackson. The only thing more disgraceful, I'm sorry, nothing, I apologize. Yeah. Nothing was more disgraceful than Sam Hinkie's performance as an executive. But the only thing close to that, to being that disgraceful, was the city of Philadelphia, a proud sports town, who was so numb to his alarming level of ineptitude that they didn't even react to how awful this team was, okay? That's the crime in it all, because this passionate city, where I worked for 17 years, should be ashamed of itself even tolerating Sam Hinkie this long. He should never, ever, ever in this lifetime be a general manager again.
Wow.
Strong words.
Blame the victim, Stephen A. It's Philly's fault that Hinkie lasted this long. Philly's
he should never have tolerated Sam Hinkie.
All right. Was it as bad as Stephen A. Smith makes it out to be?
Well, it's confusing right off the bat that in that clip, Stephen A. is judging Hinkie's performance based on wins when it was clear to everybody that that's not what he was doing.
Right.
I mean, no, he was not insightful with the media about his process, but like, why are we judging him on wins when it was so obvious from the get-go that he had a long-term plan that was about future assets and stockpiling assets and a longer view? So to judge him based on a 47-197 record seems like you're missing the boat completely.
So I was going to wait to bring up his resignation letter, more or less, which he wrote to the investors of the Sixers.
Why wait? I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of prose.
So it is a 17-page epic
13
poem.
13-page.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's 13 pages.
13 pages.
It really should have been about a 9.
You would have cut out
a good editor.
Pages.
Yeah. A good
Sam
editor.
Needed an editor.
Good editor.
In it, he mentions the 10,000-year clock, which is a clock that's being built like inside of a mountain in order to try and keep accurate time for 10,000 years without being adjusted. And he said it as though his own plan should be evaluated on a 10,000-year time scale, which I thought was really fascinating.
Well, in the year 12,015, we'll analyze his returns.
Charles Barkley is still going to be doing a TNT halftime show.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So was, from an analytics perspective, Neil, was it bad? Were the 3 years that he was doing bad as they were, you know, deeper than the 197 thing? And then also, is there any way to know whether or not he set the Sixers up for success down the line right now, right? Like, is there a value that we can put on a draft pick or something like that?
To address the first point about how, I mean, this wasn't even the worst 3-year span in NBA history. You could look at, we ran the numbers on the point margin per 100 possessions that the Sixers got outscored by over the last three seasons, and it ranks sixth worst all time. I'm not saying that that's, you know, fantastic, but the 92-94 Mavericks, the 99-01 Bulls, the 87-89 Clippers, the 96-98 Grizzlies, and the 98-2000 Clippers, two Clippers on that list, were all worse than the Sixers, despite the Sixers' best intentions to be as bad as humanly possible. There were other teams that were worse through presumably like bad luck or bad decisions, but not deliberate decisions, I guess is what I'm saying.
But Kate, you're saying we shouldn't be evaluating him on that.
Well, I'm saying that to just strictly evaluate him based on wins makes no sense when he was clearly trying to not win, and we
yeah.
were we should be evaluating him based on a future result that we can't quite evaluate him based on yet, because everything he gave up in the first 3 years was to gain assets that have yet to come to fruition, including some draft picks who are hurt or rehabbing or are still playing overseas.
I mean,
but isn't it an untenable situation to try and keep a job but not be evaluated for your performance until 5 years down the line?
Well, I mean, I think this is hard. To me, it's the equivalent of if you hire a coach at the college level, you got to give him more than 3 years, except unless you're counting extenuating circumstances, because there's a recruiting cycle. And so it's kind of like you need a minimum of 5 years. I thought the Sixers brought Hinkie in, that, like, why would they think it was a 3-year process?
Yeah. So, but the people he brought in, though, have not been very good. And Hinkie in the letter says, you know, that Joel Embiid has flashes of brilliance, and so
sure.
you know, maybe that brilliance won't pan out into anything on the court, but that you take the chance on that kind of raw and rare talent. But at some point, even if the purpose is not to win the last 3 years, the purpose is still to win a championship at some point, and Embiid would need to be a part of that if you're spending such a high pick on him.
Here's what I think is impossible to diagnose with the Hinkie situation, is that we're kind of grading him not against anything tangible that we know. When I say that, I mean that most NBA teams can make the right decision for the wrong reasons, as Hinkie outlines in the letter, right? Like, they just sort of stumble into and get lucky in the with the lottery balls, and they have the number one pick, and it so happens to be a player that everybody would draft, and they back into a level of talent on their team that then allows them to take off. And so we're kind of judging Hinkie, who did everything thoughtfully and methodically, against a version of the Sixers that maybe could have happened if somebody like Jerry Colangelo just came in and, like, was constantly trying to build rather than had a methodical plan. And of course, when you grade him against this version of the Sixers that will never exist, that version of the Sixers seems better, because everything you're doing is, like, you're getting free agent talent. That's all we see around the NBA, is guys making decisions that require expediency because they need to be good now. And then when you look at Hinkie, you're like, well, he's not being as good at now as we see around the league, therefore he's failed.
But doesn't that suggest that, first of all, that doing something like Hinkie has done, and he seemed to have gotten as much buy-in as was humanly possible or could have been asked of a team and a fan base and a front office for as long as could have been possibly asked for before returns started being demanded.
To the point where Stephen A. Smith is shaming the people of Philadelphia for giving the buy-in.
I guess I'm
3 years,
into that,
though?
Too.
I mean, that's not that long, in the grand scheme of a franchise's history. And also,
sure, of course. But also, if you think about the early returns that he had, you know, if you're putting all of your eggs in the draft basket, and that's what he did. And in his letter, he really kind of glossed over some of the mistakes that he's made in the draft, and instead started really, like, hyping up these replacement level scrubs that he, you know, picked up in the second round that turned out to be almost average players. Yay, congratulations. You know, things like that. But, for instance, Embiid has, we knew he was going to be injured, but I think he's been injured longer than the Sixers anticipated him being injured, or other draft Knicks, I guess, would have predicted before that draft. You know, he traded away Michael Carter Williams. You can say what you want about him, but it was part of this continuous churn that he had, picking up Okafor. Okafor had one of the worst rookie seasons in, you know, NBA history, maybe, among somebody who played as much as him. And so, you know, and Nerlens Noel is a deeply one-dimensional player. So if you're looking at the early returns, he hasn't drafted well, given where he drafted. And he's picked up some players that contributed later in the second round. But overall, if you're going to start pegging yourself as this, you know, putting everything on your ability to draft, you better start drafting well from the very beginning. And he didn't do that. And furthermore, there's evidence, and Sam Hinkie should know this because it's statistical evidence, that nobody can outsmart the draft, that the draft is this efficient market where over time you get what you pay for in terms of the picks that you pick at. And yeah, he was aggregating a bunch of picks, but also it seemed like in order to extend his GMing career longer than it actually actually lasted, he was going to have to overperform just to kind of offset some of the agitation. You know, just show me something, Okafor. Show me something, Embiid. And instead, they didn't show anything. And I think it would have been a lot easier for him to continue to get the buy-in to this tanking plan if any of these guys had shown even a glimmer of hope at some point. Maybe that's not fair, but at the end of the day, you have to justify yourself somehow, even if it's only 3 years. 3 years is, what's the average GM's lifespan in the NBA?
It seems like one of the easiest stats we could know right now. But I've talked to Sam before throughout his Sixers career, and like he was very cognizant of the fact that he was trying to stockpile it and get draft picks, and then also that there was a very low chance that he would necessarily do the absolute right thing with that draft pick, because he knew that it was like mostly a crapshoot. And I don't think that anybody would say, like, drafting Okafor or Embiid or any of the guys that he's drafted were the wrong pick at that time. They just have, luck-wise, seemed to have not done the thing that he wanted to do. But he's also not had a number one overall pick yet. And now you're going into this draft where the Sixers could conceivably end up with, like, Ben Simmons and Ingram if things fall their way. And then if Sam Hinkie, that was his work that set them up to have more cracks at the lottery, which they were not going to be in any position to do. People also forget how bad of a position, you say 3 years, but when he took over, they weren't just like, oh, Sixers bad. They were in the hole from that Bynum trade.
Sure. So there's a whole. Exactly. But
it's, like,
but,
it's,
I mean,
like, we're first take right now.
I know, right? We're
Chad's
actually
just
having
leaning
an
back
argument
and he's
here.
Like,
I'm
what's
letting go.
Happening?
But so, fair point about where the Sixers were, although they were the run-of-the-mill bad team, and maybe that's part of the point, is that Sam Hinkie believed that the worst place to be is in the middle or a
they
little
were
bit worse
than run-of-the-mill,
the
though, because they traded all of their first-round picks, like Vucevic and I'm forgetting who the other guy was, that were their first-round picks the previous 2 years. They traded their upcoming first-round picks and Andre Iguodala in the Bynum deal.
To get
so they
Bynum,
looked
who,
like an eighth seed, but really their future was taken out from under them.
But to push back a little bit about the idea, you said it yourself, that they never had a number one pick. They had the worst record a number of years, and they had the highest probability of getting the number one pick. And the fact that they didn't get the number one pick out of that also shows that when we think about tanking, we think about, okay, you got to get bad, and then once you get bad, you'll get the number one pick, and then you'll pick the right player, and then it'll turn things around. But think about the layers of luck and fortune that have to kind of come onto there. Not only do you have to pick the right player if you have the number one pick, but it's actually kind of unlikely, even if you have the worst record in the NBA, that you will get the number one pick because of the way the lottery is set up. And that's an indictment of tanking in general, is you can lay this plan, and he did the best job he could of laying this tank up plan for a number of years, and it still didn't even yield the prize pick. The number one pick in the NBA draft is orders of magnitude expected to put up more wins than the number two or the number three pick. So even that in and of itself is an indictment of what he can't control. So and he was very mealy-mouthed about that in his letter, where he said, you know, you have to be cognizant of uncertainty and you have to recognize what you can't control. But at the same time, he was behaving in a manner in which he could control things, and he believed that he had more control than he actually had.
But there was no other way for the Sixers to get a star than to go by the luck of the draft. Because you look back over the last 10 years, who's the biggest free agent draw they had? Elton Brand coming off an Achilles injury?
That's true.
I mean, it's not like Philly is a place that even if they free up cap room, they're getting the kind of level of superstar.
But
he
it's
knew
not like
that
the Golden
wasn't
State
an option,
Warriors
though.
Went out and
Golden
got players.
State?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they picked Curry. Where did Curry go in the first round? He wasn't number one. He wasn't number two or number three.
But there were, I mean, I remember the Knicks that year were desperate to get Curry. It's not like the Golden State Warriors were like the only team who thought that he was a good value.
Okay, well, look at Kawhi Leonard. Look at all of the teams that have built. Look at the Atlanta Hawks last year especially. I mean, these are teams that didn't take the tanking route. They actually got talent. You know, the lie of tanking is that the only way to get good is to get these kinds of generational talents that you can get with the number one pick. But the thing is that if you look around the league at who's good, aside from Cleveland, who got LeBron, you know, through free agency, a lot of the teams that are good got that way through means that wouldn't have been available or even occurred to a team that was tanking.
But the only other thing Hinkie could have done was come in and just be like, I'm going to go do the same path everybody does, hope I get lucky and draft well. At least he was like, I have a specific plan I'm executing, and yes, I also need luck, But I'm not just relying on a Chad's like, stop. We need to stop.
No. You finish your thought.
I'm putting on my cape for Hanky right now.
Okay.
So we can get him on this podcast.
But here's though, Kate, I think one question. Is it better to fail with a plan than it is to fail without a plan?
I think
that's what I kept coming back to when I think about Hinky, right? Because we talk all the time about evaluating decision makers on process rather than outcome. And was the process sound? Neil is making the point the process was not sound because, as Hinky himself writes, the illusion of control is an opiate. And you can't control the NBA lottery until Adam Silver starts riding into a pool of fish, riding a bear.
But there's also been a lot of studies that showed that the easiest way to get to be a good team or even a borderline great team, and maybe this, and we can talk about this, is this an indictment of the winner-take-all obsession with championships being the only thing? But just to finish my point is that, you know, the way to get from a 41-win team to a 55-win team isn't to start at 15 wins. It's actually to start at 41 wins or even 35 wins and to incrementally add good players until you actually
have... But that's what we talked about last year with the Atlanta Hawks. Look where the Hawks are now. So we're like, oh, look at them. They came from the middle.
They're
and
the
now,
third seed in the East.
Yeah, and with absolute... What's their... When 538 comes out with their NBA championship odds, when
we
the playoffs start,
that.
where are they going to be? Like, yes, they can get like higher up, but there's still no proven way. It's not... And I'm not arguing that it's just, oh, tank and get a superstar, because yes, there are different ways to go about it, but I'm saying at least it's like when you play blackjack and you're like, oh, I'm gonna hit on 16, and then later on when you're playing you're like, oh, I'm scared to hit on 16. You either gotta always hit on 16 or never hit on 16. I guess the thing that I like about Hinky is that he always hit on 16.
What's amazing is both of you are making, I think, pretty analytics-y arguments, right? Kate's talking about the process and having a long window to evaluate it, and Neil, you're arguing that having a process is not enough, that you still need to maximize the efficiency of your process in the first place, and Hinky perhaps didn't do that within the confines and the rules set by the NBA.
Right.
The Hawks have a 3% chance of winning the NBA title.
So the that's Warriors where the Sixers could be if they'd chance. Done it differently.
Well, that's
so,
a lot more than the Sixers.
But Neil, one question I have for you is this a change in what we believe to be the savvy thing to do within the NBA now? Because I do feel like tanking was the rage for a little bit. I remember the Mark Cuban one offseason. I think it was an offseason where he either did get a point guard he wanted or barely missed out on one. And he said
Derek
if he
Lugs?
Hadn't, I forget. It was before Darren Williams. Anyways, but he said if we hadn't gotten this guy, then we would have tanked. I forgot who it was.
Right, I remember that.
But and so as a result, you know, Cuban, who
it was actually,
I think,
Tyson Chandler, who then
really?
Went
wow.
back to. Not Tyson Chandler, I'm sorry, DeAndre Jordan, right?
Oh, was it
wasn't
that
it
Jordan?
DeAndre Jordan?
Oh,
and
that
then,
was that summer.
But then he actually ended up, yeah.
But they'd already signed
right.
another guy with DeAndre,
right.
and they were like, whoa.
Yeah. So, but this is my question. Has Hinkie's tenure, at least in the interim 4 years before he's feted as a genius when the Sixers are good 4 years from now because of the five draft picks or whatever it is that they have this year, for now is tanking out of vogue within the NBA because of how bad the Sixers have been? Because the Sixers have been bad not just on the court, but also revenue-wise. And I thought Hinkie's letter to investors was super interesting because if I would think that investors were the ones hurting the most, perhaps aside from fans, depending on, you know, whether you think emotion or money matters more.
That was interesting to try and tease out because the Sixers were bought by Josh Harris. In fact, my last year on the beat, and they've like all NBA franchises after the Clippers sale, like the value of the Sixers is like six times what they paid Ed Snyder, RIP, for the Sixers a few years ago. So yes, if you're talking about a bottom line on a year-by-year basis, but they also had so much capital that they'd gained back from buying at the absolute right time that I would think that they could take, they were able to take the long view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But going back to the point about tanking being all the rage, I do think it traces back to, if you think about before the Lakers built that presumptive super team that had Dwight Howard on top of Kobe, on top of Steve Nash, just all the players that they had on that team, everybody was pressing the panic button, especially because the Heat had built their team and shown that it could actually win a championship at that point. Everyone was saying, oh my God, we can't win now. If you're not in one of these destinations and you can't build through free agency or somehow get the number one pick, through tanking, then you don't have a chance to build a team. And I think everything that's happened since, from that Laker team failing to these LeBron, you know, LeBron and that Heat team breaking up, and now with the Cavs, you know, not being, you know, a world killer. And then the teams that have risen since then, like San Antonio just rebuilding on the fly using picks like Kawhi Leonard, and then the, you know, I don't know, I know you don't want to talk about the Warriors here, Kate, but they drafted Draymond Green 35th overall. They drafted Steph Curry 7th, Klay Thompson 11th. These are the types of picks that actually kind of cut against tanking.
You can't.
Because you could get those picks without having to bottom out.
But, Neil, you can't say that the Warriors drafting Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and Draymond Green was some sort of, like, prophecy, and they had those
picks. Oh, sure, that was luck, too.
And those were luck, too, in the same way that, like, the Sixers getting guys who maybe haven't performed well is luck as well.
But that doesn't say that, like, what if it's the same level of luck no matter what eggs, you know, whether you put your eggs in the tanking basket or the build from the middle basket, then that would imply that you should build from the middle, because at least then you're not going to alienate a whole generation of
fans.
No,
because if you tank, you have more eggs in the basket.
I'm cutting this off.
That's the whole point.
This
now
basket
the
metaphor
Sixers
has gone
have
too far.
More eggs in the basket. And if it's all luck and you have more eggs in the basket, that's the better place to
but
be.
But they're rotten eggs that have already been in the basket, Kate.
Let's extend this metaphor even further. Do we even need to do another segment?
Stinky for life. Sam, if you're listening,
come on,
we know
podcast.
You were on Zach Lowe's podcast the day before you resigned. And we know that you could be on our podcast a week or two after you resigned.
Or, you know, or a month after.
Yeah.
Or 3 weeks.
We're ready for you.
We're ready.
All right. That'll bring us to the end of our Sam Hinky segment. I think we need him to get another job just so we can keep talking about him, you know? NBA teams, hire him so that we can keep talking. Kate and Neil are doing a makeup high five.
I didn't think we were fighting.
All right.
I thought we were
it's
elevating
all for the
show.
On to hockey, where I'm sure we will be just as animated.
It's going
to
be
passionate. All right. The Stanley Cup playoffs are here.
Woohoo!
And who the hell knows what's going to happen? No team has greater odds to win than the Washington Capitals, and even they don't break 17% in an average of Vegas and market predictions that Neil put together. Is this year's playoffs as difficult to predict as it seems, Neil? And is it any more difficult than usual given the randomness of hockey?
I'm not totally sure, because there's some interesting things going on in the NHL this year that could manifest themselves in the playoffs. And the first thing is, this was a weird year for possession stats. We've talked in the past about how the analytic wave of thinking in the NHL is that things like shooting percentage or how often your goalie stops the puck, those are kind of ephemeral. And really what drives long-term lasting success is your ability to maintain possession and keep pressure on the opponent. And so those stats, they go by names like Corsi and Fenwick and all kinds of fun things. Those have been really predictive in the past of how good a team will be. But there might be some kind of diminishing returns going on this year. Aside from some weird blip in 2008, this year was the lowest correlation between how high a team finished in the standings and their Corsi, even after doing things like adjusting for score effects and rink effects and things like that.
When you say diminishing return, you mean that it's possible that all the teams in the league have gotten the memo on Corsi, the way that baseball teams have gotten the memo on base percentage, for example, and therefore, if all the teams are trying to do similar things, that it's not as predictive of quality as it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part is true, that the league has gotten the memo in general about this and has gone about getting players who are good at it and phasing out the players who aren't. And all you have to do is even look at, like, the composition of third and fourth lines now, where they have players who are skilled and fast and puck-controlling players instead of goons like in the past. And so I don't know if that's what's causing this effect, but it could very well have caused the effect. And so when Corsi becomes less connected to winning, it kind of cuts against what we've seen in the NHL playoffs the past few years, because the Stanley Cup winner each of the past 3 years actually has been the single season, you know, the regular season leader in Corsi. Blackhawks in 2015, the Kings in 2014, the Blackhawks again in 2013. So I don't know, that seems to be suggesting that the teams that are best at possession, and this year's best possession team is the Kings again. Pittsburgh had a resurgent year. Tampa Bay, Dallas, teams like that, are going to be the teams to watch for in the playoffs. And Chicago, having an uncharacteristically down possession year, might not be favored to repeat. Or if we just don't know as much as we used to know, and that this kind of magic bullet has gotten less effective over time.
Well, is it that maybe Corsi is more important in the postseason?
Maybe that's true too, yeah.
In the regular season, it seems like, at least this year, the correlation isn't quite there. But we see all kinds of crazy things happen in NHL postseason because goaltending and everything we always talk about. So maybe it becomes more important?
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly during the regular season, the standings are set up to be so weird with like the overtime loss point
exactly.
and all of those things. But mentioning goaltending, the other interesting thing that I found statistically this season was that it just was like, not a dominant year for goaltending. Most years seem to have like one or two guys that have really good, you know, single season goaltending performances, and you can kind of, you know, the book on the NHL playoffs is that it's a tournament to determine the league's hottest goalie, and you know, whatever team that goalie is associated with is usually the cup winner. But in this case, Ben Bishop was the probably the most valuable goalie of Tampa Bay during the season, maybe Corey Crawford of Chicago, and they didn't really have great years compared to other league-leading seasons in the past. Like, Carey Price had an excellent year last year. We saw Tim Thomas, you know, put the Boston Bruins on his back and carry them. So it's kind of interesting in that regard, too, because hot goaltending, maybe that's not the answer. We can't predict that, particularly so.
So we just
season.
Cannot, like, putting analysis on hockey is just proving slippery.
Also, linguistic metaphor, goaltenders can stand on their head and put teams on their back.
That's true.
That's,
at the same
time. That's
quite
a feat.
At the same
time. To do a headstand and have someone hanging on.
Some sort,
yeah, that's
right
good.
There.
All right. So I also want to talk about the Penguins, who have made a great run at the end of the season. They've been the hottest team coming into the playoffs. And one thing I was reading on the Washington Post on the Fancy Stats blog suggested that maybe they're too good at the end of the season, that the level that they're playing at is so obviously unsustainable. This is like the Danny Murphy argument that we had come the World Series. I'm shocked that that name even could come out of my mouth, and now that he's a traitorous
such a traitor
national.
Well, you're reading that Washington paper, so I don't know.
It's true.
As a New Yorker, that's how Danny Murphy... you're already a traitor reading a Washington paper, right?
I should just ban the URL.
Yeah.
Takedown listeners should also ban all Nationals podcast and listen to Panic City, the new Mets podcast from Neil and Chad. Look at that.
Wow.
Seamless
plug.
Wow.
Seamless.
Sneaking that plug.
Meanwhile, so the Penguins might be too good, which is sort of crazy to say. They have a their even strength shooting percentage, so shooting percentage when they have the same number of players on the ice as their opponent, ended the season at 9.9%, which is sort of unheard of, is my understanding. And so I'm wondering, Neil, is there any reason to think that that there will be more of a regression to a mean in the playoffs than in any other stretch of games? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
because
you're playing against higher
hot,
or because
late, or
and because you're playing against the same team repeatedly, which
and
is
better
sort of like grinding to a halt
and better competition. And so theoretically, if someone is going to expose, you know, is going to stop you from playing as well, it's going to be a better team as opposed to playing
in
maybe
a team
a
that has like repeated cracks at you,
right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure, being able to game plan things, we see this in, you know, any sport that has a series-based playoff structure, is you just are able to learn things really quickly. By the end of it, sometimes series look different. But also, I mean, I think it's kind of weird that the Penguins would, you know, they did play very well at the end of the season, but sort of from an all's well that ends well perspective, their contributors were pretty much the same as in the past. Sidney Crosby, best player on the team. Marc-Andre Fleury had a good year. Chris Letang, Evgeny Malkin. So it's not like they had players who were sort of like playing above their head
no
to
Danny
get
Murphy's
them to that level. There was no Daniel Murphy hitting, you know, a home run in every playoff game. It's the same guys. We know that these guys are good. So maybe there's a bit of the gambler's fallacy there where you feel like if a team didn't play to their potential early in the season, that they have but clearly they're going to end up at their full season projection by the end of the season, so they're just going to play that much better to catch up. I don't know if that played into people's minds when they saw Pittsburgh playing well at the end of the season, but I don't know. I'd be more interested in the Washington Capitals, who, like you mentioned, were the favored team to win it all, because that franchise has been you know, it seems like every other year they go into the playoffs favored to, you know, make noise in the playoffs, and they've never really advanced that deep. I think the furthest they've gone is the conference semis or some such. And so I don't know.
The conference finals is 98, I think it is.
Yeah. And that year they went to the Stanley Cup finals and were swept. So
how do you know that off the top of your head?
I was a hockey fan when I was 12 years old.
It can't be because he has a computer in front
of
him.
No, he did it blind. You just recalled the fate of the 1998 Washington Capitals.
Peter Bondra and Adam Oates and...
Oh, my God.
He is a superhero.
Olaf Kolzig were very important to me growing up. So, but what I'm trying to say is that Washington is a team that a lot of people are still skeptical of, even though they had the best record in hockey during the regular season. They're the betting market's favorite. They're the stats favorite to win the Stanley Cup. But they've just never put it together. So I think an interesting litmus test of does clutch exist, or, you know, are there these teams that are just chronically incapable?
They're like the opposite of Michigan State in the NCAA
tournament. Exactly. Is Alex Ovechkin the anti-Izzo? And we said that about Villanova, and you know what? They proved it wrong, and who knows if the Capitals will prove it wrong.
I think we should talk about the Stanley Cup playoffs throughout the Stanley Cup playoffs.
What a concept.
Wow, we should?
Yeah. I like hockey. I went to a hockey game a couple weeks ago.
Radical ideas. It's crazy.
I went to a hockey game a couple weeks ago, my first in years in person. You know what? I had a great time. It's
hockey
fast.
In person.
It's cold. The players, you can really see their athleticism even from the upper decks. I had a great time.
That's great.
Wow. Chad, you have just sold. You've done what.
I've discovered a new
sport,
guys.
You've done what Gary Bettman could not have done over the last 20 years, which is sold hockey to an American audience.
All right. Let's move on, Sig Diggs, since you're now mocking me. Significant digit is when we find a number, a telling number from the world of sports. Kate, do you want to introduce this week's Sig Dig?
Yeah. We actually had this on Around the Horn today.
Oh.
And the folks on Around the Horn didn't seem as impressed as I was that a Detroit Tigers fan corralled 5 foul balls in one game.
In one game.
Now, as a youngster, I remember counting 17 Boston Red Sox games.
When did you count in your young life?
Yeah. Okay. I was always like...
And you've like tattooed that onto your brain?
Yes. Okay. And so I only went to 2 Mets games, which was odd. But my mom's family was from Boston. Anyway, it's a tangent. And I never caught a foul ball. So I'm like, how do you catch 5 in 1? And also, and then I sent it to you guys. I was like, what are the odds of this happening? And the odds were 1 in 262 trillion.
Is that right, Neil? 1 in 262 trillion? How did you get that number?
I'm the one who calculated that. So
that's our significant
buyer
digit.
Beware one on that.
Did I not present that properly?
No, it's fine. Should it be 5 foul balls or should it be 1 in 262
Which
trillion?
Which is the likelihood give or take of a few catching trillion. 5 foul balls at Comerica Park.
Either way, so I came to that by, there's very, you know, obviously, I've never caught a foul ball either in my life. And so there are a variety of websites out there that tried to estimate your odds of catching not just a foul ball, but also a home run ball, you know, any kind of ball that leaves the field of play and ends up in the stands. And there's different estimates. Some ranged as high as 1 in 1,000, even after you make an assumption that probably about 15% of seats, and it could be even more.
I was going to say, does it matter where I sit?
And does it take into account attendance?
Deeply. It deeply matters. Some of these models,
because you can scramble to the empty seat next to you.
Yeah.
Right. Density should matter.
That's
absolutely.
And he also was sitting on the aisle in a certain section where if anything went over his head a couple rows, he could run back into the pathway.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm sure if you heat mapped the areas of the stands where balls were most likely to appear, there would be some that were far more likely than others. And so this doesn't really take into account that. It sort of assumes like at an average location. It does try to filter out things like, are you in a place where there's just zero chance of ever catching a ball? So assuming that you're in a place where it's theoretically possible to catch a ball, it could be 1 in 1,000. It could be 1 in about 600. And if you average those together, you get about 1 in 765. And so the odds of catching 5 balls in one game, if your odds of catching just one ball in one game are 1 in 765 work out to 1 in 262 trillion. But, I mean, there's a lot of wiggle room in there. If you said your odds were 1 in 500, it becomes 1 in 31 trillion. But the odds are still pretty low. And I should say also that I think they did a thing on SportsCenter a number of years ago where they looked at a guy who – this was his thing. His claim to fame, he would go to baseball games and just come home with a bunch of balls. And his key was that he would stand in the aisles and he would roam around and basically be in – I don't know if he moneyballed it and actually kind of tracked it or not, but be in those high-density areas that you talked about, Kate, so, and then just kind of roam around and take balls from unsuspecting poor children that otherwise would have gotten balls.
At least this guy was giving away the
baseballs. He gave the balls away. So that was the best part.
He was like Robin Hood.
Yes.
My final word on foul ball catching. As a kid who grew up, you know, nice middle-class life, I think there's an income inequality problem about foul ball catching, which is you got to pretty much – if you want one of these high – density locations, you got to sit in the ground level, basically.
You got to pony up.
And, you know, I think that's unfair. That the children of America should have equal access to foul ball catching.
And not only that,
this is my platform when I run on the Bernie ticket.
There are kids I read about during the course of doing research for this. There was a kid that went to a Red Sox-Yankees game, and he heretically wore both Red Sox and Yankees gear. He was seated right behind the dugout. And so he would, when the Red Sox players came near, he would go up to the railing and wear Red Sox stuff and say, hey, you know, could you give me a ball? And then when Yankee players passed by, he would do a quick change and become a Yankee fan and also do the same thing. And that also
is
the product of privilege by being that close,
right,
for sure.
All right. That'll do it for this week's show, I think. We've solved a lot.
We've touched all the bases.
Hey, that's good.
Thank you.
Kay Fagan, nice puns. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Chad.
Nick Payne, I gotta say, maybe your best performance in months.
Wow.
I'm gonna have to have somebody else run the numbers on the Neil Payne podcast, Elo.
My VORP.
Yeah.
My...
Your value over replacement podcaster.
Oh my God, Chad.
Woo!
It's not that hard. You said you said VORP.
I said it without thinking
P
of the
podcaster.
Acronym. Someone would bail me out, and you did.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast overlord is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Nails. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. Your favorite podcast app, actually. We're there. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. You can subscribe to Hot Takedown, that is. 538 has other podcasts. We've got an elections podcast. We've got a data and society podcast called What's the Point? Neil, I see you
We
itching.
Won't be mad if you listen to those.
Yeah, but we will be mad if you don't listen to Panic City, Neil and my Mets podcast. There's plenty to panic about right now in Mets land. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.